Siege mentality, Jerry. They really want me out of here. They've downgraded me to some kind of a bunker. I'm like Hitler's last days in here. I'm vigilant. They'll never get me out. I'm like a weed, Jerry. I'm a weed in Hitler's bunker. I tried to find the Seinfeld clip of this, but I could not find it on YouTube or anywhere else. But there is a great scene. I'm a big Seinfeld mark, in case you didn't know. And there's a great scene where George is Play Now, the company that he worked for, I think, after the Yankees, just hated him with all of their might. Long story about it. Basically, he faked that he was handicapped, and they found out and all this kind of stuff and hated him because of it. But ultimately, they just kept downgrading and downgrading and downgrading his work conditions, and then finally he reveals that line. And that's how I feel right now, because I'm hidden up in our bedroom behind the bed just to film this opening for this, because the whole family is home, and they have been home for a couple of weeks now due to coronavirus. So I'm really happy that I was ahead of the curve and recorded 6 or 7 weeks of interviews ahead of time, and that way I could make sure that I had good content for everybody coming out. And what's cool is that this week's episode is a two-parter, and Dr. Dan Ratner is back. So part one you'll hear this week, part two you'll hear next week. And it's interesting because we recorded this a month or a month and a half before, and we talked a tiny bit about coronavirus and what'll happen and that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because now the world is in a full-on pandemic with it. So before I jump into that, let me give a shout out to a brand new patron of the podcast since the last time that I went through, but Tara Smith, who is a past guest. Thank you so much, Tara. And then also Serena Sterling. She was also a past guest. So cool to get past guests that decide to put something towards the show. Patreon.com/ The Mind and Fitness Podcast. You'll get a shout out every single week on this. Sometimes I put out podcasts early, bonus content. I always would love to take question and answer, do bonus shows, things like that. So if you have any ideas and you're a patron, please send me an email and we can get something together. Shout out to Victoria and Chad and Anthony and Jennifer and Eddie and Jenny and Sean, Christina, Holly, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Stan, Kristen, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. Thank you so much for being supporters of the podcast. Also, I don't know if you saw, the podcast got a brand new logo. You've probably seen that as you're in your podcast app now. That was actually done by a very close personal friend, babysitter for the girls. We love her as if she was a member of our own family, Alyssa. Won't do the last name because I didn't get clearance from her, but I think it looked awesome. She put that thing together in, I don't know, 30 minutes or something like that, and I think it just looks great. Freehand drew the brain, which is pretty awesome. That's a part of the logo. So I am interested in getting a new theme song done. So if you're listening to this and you have some musical talent, I would love for you to consider. I'm thinking about something that's maybe a little bit softer on a guitar, something acoustic. Doesn't have to have any words, but a cool intro would be awesome to have. So if you are interested in donating something like that, I would, of course, give you a shout out on the podcast and promote as much as I could. So if you or somebody you know could whip something up and would be interested, just let me know. Shoot me an email, eddie@themindandfitnesspodcast.com. So Dan is back, Dr. Dan Ratner. I got a lot of great feedback from him in the last episode. He actually did a TMS manifesto that is available in our group, the Mind and Fitness Podcast, The Leaders of Pain, that's available there right now, free for all members, if you would like. So if you are listening to this and you haven't seen that, you can go on over to the Facebook group and join, and you'll get access to it immediately. So I think next week when this airs, I'll probably just go right into the meeting, or not the meeting, but part two of the interview. Without further ado, here is Dr. Dan Ratner. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Right after I finished rolling an episode recently, I had asked the person that I was interviewing, hey man, we got to do this again, and might have given it away a little bit when I said, hey man, but Dr. Dan Ratner is back on the line with me. Dan, are you there?
I am here. It's good to be with you, Eddie.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for joining us. The last episode got so much positive feedback, and I got a lot of messages. And I got a lot of messages particularly from, and this is going to lead us into the first thing that I kind of want to ask you about, a lot of messages particularly from men. And we can sort of talk back and forth on a couple of these things, but one thing that I often wonder about in this kind of stuff, and maybe you can help clear the air or give your hypothesis on it, but I get a lot of statistics from the from the podcast publisher that I use. It tells me the demographics, who's listening, where are they listening from. Month after month, without fail, for the last 3 years, the listenership has been 70% female. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the people that I interview on here are also female. What's going on? Why do you think so many more listeners are female than there are male?
It's a great question. It's actually the central thing that I was left thinking about after we met last time. I was thinking, okay, he asked this great question. I'm like, why is that? I mean, from what you said, I'm only the second psychologist who treats TMS that has come on.
Yep.
Eric Sherman being the first.
Right? Yep.
So I was like, wow, that's staggering. So to me, there's two different questions. There's why are there so – maybe there's – well, look, with me, there's always multiple questions. Maybe one question is why have so few of those kinds of therapists come on? Another question is why is the listening – viewership is a funny word for listening, but why is it broken down that way? I would say that, you know, as I thought about it, I think a lot of it comes down to how we're raised societally. I started thinking about, well, is this just in America or is this everywhere? I can more speak to America, obviously, but, you know, the whole idea of boys don't cry is a very, very powerful one. And I think that I've kind of had to fight hard throughout my life to keep the kind of identity that I like, which is, I'd say, more identified with women in a lot of ways. And, you know, I had to navigate all of school. You know, it's not like I was secretly a woman walking around, but I did have a sensitive side to me, and I knew that, you know, out on the playground, just throw the football. Don't bring that up. And I wonder how much that continues to affect how much people can go get help. I think it's much more permissible for women to go get help. I think there's all kinds of problems in society that make other things not possible for women. In fact, I think there's much more of that than the other way around. But I think that men have a hard time. I think because we've been sent the message that it's not okay to kind of be sensitive or have those feelings. It's one of the things I really appreciated about talking with you is that I felt like you were a kindred spirit right away. And I think it's really important that there be men out there who fight for that place in society. Like Mr. Rogers is a great hero of mine. And it's because he was doing that. Even when I was a kid, I was looking and I was like, okay, here's a man who isn't afraid to do this. And, you know, he can be quirky and weird and, you know, but in ways that I really appreciate. And we need men like that.
Did you watch the Tom Hanks movie?
I didn't get to watch it yet.
Oh man. My wife and I, we usually go back and forth on suggestions of movie. You know, she picks one and then I pick one. And so last weekend she had picked that and I was kind of like, and I love Tom Hanks. It just wasn't, Mr. Rogers was just before my time. I think his show may have been wrapping up as I was cognizant of even what TV was. And I,
so you have a whole different relationship to cardigans than,
yes, my exposure was basically my bosses when I worked in grocery stores to cardigans. That was kind of it. And then you can't really call it a cardigan, but we could say a vest. The motorcycle community, the Harley guys are always big vest wearers.
They don't usually wear cardigans.
Yeah, no, they don't. They're not wearing cardigans. We got 20% through it and it was just blowing my mind. And then when it ended, I was like, what did I just watch? It was so good. And I texted a buddy of mine who runs a TMS group with me. And I'm like, you need to watch this. And I had said that there's a particular scene in there. And if you've seen this, you'll know the scene, but it's the diner scene. They're in a diner or a restaurant or something. And the thing that Mr. Rogers prompts the main character to do is exactly the somatic practice that I do when I need to like settle the hell down. And I was just going, this is amazing. It almost makes me want to go back and watch a couple of Mr. Rogers episodes. Cause that's not how I didn't remember it being so feeling driven, right? I may have seen a couple of scenes or whatever, but that he would use the word feelings and he would use the word emotions a lot. And I feel like it's interesting because the other guy that I interviewed, Dr. Sherman, had said that one of the challenges that he thinks develops with people over time, and maybe why they develop some of this stuff, and one of the bigger hurdles is just simply developing a vocabulary around this, being able to say, I feel this way, or I have feelings in this way. And so, I was going to say, I just thought it was so interesting that how Tom Hanks portrayed him was using a lot of these vocabulary words, that was a big part of it, was the dialogue.
Yeah, and there's such a physical element to people who really are deeply feeling. I remember there was an episode, this pretty well-known episode because of what it was, but I think the police officer in the neighborhood was African American, and he invited him to soak his feet in his tub with him. It's like sitting around like a kiddie pool, and they put their feet in together, and there was something so, it was like the kind of thing little kids would do, but grown-ups don't do that. And there was the physicality of it, of the welcoming, was just a whole different ball of wax. And I think, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, how do you think, it's just coming to me, and this is a conversation I was having with another therapist over social media not long ago, but I was saying that one of the things that's really interesting is that it feels like seeking out like mental health help and, you know, prioritizing mental health. There's like a mental health month, mental health awareness month now. And yet I feel like there's a lot of blockades, maybe with the way that there's like a lot of political correctness and there's a lot more sensitivity to certain things, which I think is very much a good thing. However, I don't know if I can imagine a show like Mr. Rogers being quote unquote okay today. Does that make sense? Like if there were two guys sitting around putting their feet in a pool, I feel like people would say that's weird, right? But this show was around in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Do you think I'm wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I mean, it's just such an interesting question because I think that sometimes when we are trying to be super inclusive, we end up being exclusive or we close something off. I actually really found this when I was at Brown. It's one of the most liberal places that you can go, but it was the policing of what we were talking about was so strong that we almost couldn't really talk to each other. I don't know if that's what you're thinking with that, but that was what my thinking was on that.
Yep. Same idea that I feel like if there is so much political correctness and all that kind of stuff, that inherently that seems to repress something, because if it's not okay to say, then maybe inherently we think it's not okay to think and it's not okay to feel.
Right. Not okay to show things. And I think that I really appreciate that point, because one of the things that I work on in my work as a therapist, but also just as a person, is to encourage people to be themselves. There are these little moments that happen to people, and these are very important for TMS work, actually. There's these little moments that happen where people apologize for who they are. And I watch for it very carefully, because it can happen in very, very subtle ways. You know, where they'll be like, oh, you know, I said something and that was weird. And I'll stop them off. I mean, look, I can't always stop them or sometimes we're in the flow of something, but I might say, hey, I think you didn't realize it, but you were being hard on yourself in a way where you're negating who you are. So let's jump back there. Let's be proud of who you were there. What was going on? Because we all hide. And somaticization, TMS stuff, it's all about the things we've had to hide from the world. And one of the things, we started talking about this last time, and I thought this was really, I was really glad that we got to this point last time, but the idea of power in the work that I do is not something I hear talked about by other TMS practitioners, at least not in that way. But what I mean by that is the ability to be fully oneself. And that's, you know, that's what I loved about Mr. Rogers. That's what I love about the work that I do. And I love that there's these subtle ways that I can support people. You know, tell them, no, you're good enough as you are.
It seems like it ties right. When you're picking up little subtleties, somebody sort of apologizing who they are, I feel like a lot of times there's also almost like an apology for a particular action. Like, as an example, if somebody's telling a story to anybody, it could just be between two friends, and somebody starts crying, they'll stop and they'll apologize.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And look, I understand. I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. In fact, I have a hard time crying. I'm not happy about that. I'd like to be able to cry more easily. The times I can cry are when I feel that it is so societally acceptable that nobody would mind. Like at my cousin's funeral, I cried, and that didn't bother me. I certainly wasn't going to apologize for that. But there are other times where I could cry and I could feel embarrassed about it, or I could feel worried about the effect on the other person. And I think it's interesting because I think there's a divide between people and emotions. We keep them inside ourselves, and it's part of the task of being a child is to figure out, okay, what do I do? You know, you see a child throw a temper tantrum, they're letting the feelings out there all over the place, and the messages they get generally are very negative. Now, of course, it's understandable from the adult perspective. It's really unpleasant. You know, I have two kids, and you know, when they throw temper tantrums, it's awful. But when adults throw temper tantrums, it's even worse. So we have to figure out how do we share what's inside of us. And I really think at some level that's at the heart of TMS. You know, it's at the heart of what do we do about it? Even, you know, how do we live our true selves?
You know, I had this moment yesterday with my older daughter, Zoe, who is no human on the planet that can make me as happy or as upset in back to back minutes. Right.
Yeah.
And she was, you know, we have our routine in the morning, and she was getting her clothes, you know, getting ready and getting her clothes on and stuff. And she came downstairs with as we record this, it is a Friday. So I'm talking about an incident on a Thursday. She came down with the exact same clothes that she had on, I think it was on Monday or Tuesday. And they're like, you know, spaghetti sauce stained, you know, sweater, spaghetti sauce stained pants.
Yep.
'Cause she eats like a wildebeest and in the cutest possible way. But I had asked her where she got those. She said the dirty clothes. And I was like, no, can you go back and just put some? I thought she was just kidding around. So I asked her to just go put on some clean clothes, and she had said no. And we kind of went back and forth and did this thing and got her sister ready for school. And I was like, okay, Zoe, because one of the things she really likes to do when we drop her little sister off at preschool is to go inside and say hi to her old teachers, you know, when she used to go there before she got to elementary school. And so, you know, I start doing that. I'm going to take that thing away thing. And I'm like, we're not going to go see those teachers. She's like, I don't care. And I was like, okay, I really need you to go. You need to go change. And she just kept saying no. And I was like, okay, fine, we're leaving. And I just sort of like huffed and puffed, right? And I wasn't saying anything to her in the car. And then when we got out and we're like halfway to her building, like at her school, and I just reached down and I just started holding her hand, and we were walking to class. And when I got there, like just kind of these thoughts came over me where I was just thinking, like, I don't know, I couldn't exactly put my finger on why I was so sad at that moment, because I was so angry and flustered earlier. And I'm not one to like raise my voice, so the expression of anger doesn't happen really very often at all. It's the bottling in kind of thing. And we got to her classroom, and I knelt down on one knee, and I just explained to her that I wish that you were wearing different clothes. However, I said that this is not a big deal, and we'll just try again tomorrow, and I really love you. And, you know, just gave her a hug. But I just left because the thought that I had that was coming over me as we were walking to class and I started having that feeling of sadness was I literally started to envision myself dying yesterday, like last night. Like, right. Like thinking, if I go, this is how she's going to remember Dad, as being upset about these clothes. Like, that was the thing that came over me.
I totally get it. And I live my life that way. I can't remember. Did we talk about my childhood at all last time? I'm not recalling.
I don't think it was much.
Okay. Well, my father passed away when I was 6 weeks old. So, my mom remarried, and then I was subsequently adopted by my father now, who I just think of as my dad. But I have this feeling of the hovering of mortality always. And so I can really relate to what you're talking about. I'm always thinking, okay, what is this person going to feel if that was my last interaction with them?
Right.
So this is right in line with things that I think. And I don't know if I'm right about this, and you can tell me, but I've had moments like that where the sadness will come over me after the anger. And I think, to me, it relates to the fact that we're returning to our sense of what really matters.
Yeah.
That spaghetti stains don't matter. That what matters is those little people feel that we love them no matter what. And you did a great job there. I mean, you did a great job connecting with yourself about what was happening and letting something unfold. So that's really impressive parenting, but I also think so good for her that in the end you said, look, this isn't what matters. Because the repair is often more important than avoiding the problem in the first place. It's
right.
Like with people who had trauma, the denial of trauma is often worse than the trauma. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we were having this...
That was traumatic.
Right, yeah. We were having a similar discussion. I guess it's sort of along the same lines, and maybe it's not along the same lines, but I'd be curious to get some of your take on it, because I'm, you know, I don't know if the majority of people that you work with now are in the chronic pain realm, but I imagine they probably are. And so we had some friends over a couple weeks ago, and we were having this discussion about some friends of ours in the past who have had... terminal like cancer diagnosis, but the worst possible kinds, right? The ones where the doctors literally say you've got a year, you've got 6 months, you've got 2 years or whatever. And the immediate reaction typically of the family, because these are friends of ours, of like a family member of them is, I remember one in particular had reached out to all of the friends and had said, this just happened. I know you're going to see this person this weekend. Don't talk about it at all. Pretend like nothing happened. And in the months after that, I remember the person with the cancer had said that was like the worst possible thing, because everybody's standing around at this party and nobody's allowed to talk about it. And then they started, you know, making jokes or remarks about their own, sort of help them cope a little bit better, right?
And suddenly they're taking care of the other people.
Right. Yeah, and it's like, I mean, that's no... it's not meant to be fun, but it's certainly no fun to go when there's something like that. And I think like I wasn't at the party that was being talked about, and so I didn't have the opportunity to not talk about it. But I remember when that advice was given, and I had said to my wife, like, because I for quite a few years I worked with kids that had neuromuscular disease, and a lot of times they would be diagnosed with like Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which typically is like a 12 to 13 year lifespan. And you know, in situations like that, like where you know a lot of kids that like, you know, that they're probably going to last a decade ish, you would think that the thing is to not talk about it, pretend it's not there. But what we were always taught was bring that stuff to the forefront, you know, talk about these things and make it, because you're normalizing and making it okay.
And also that's how you're present with people. And the lack of presence that people bring is one of the more damaging things that can happen. I don't say that critically of anybody who's struggled with that, because we've all struggled with that at times. But what I try to do is to stay present. And as a parent, as a therapist, as a friend, as a family member, whoever I'm with, or even whatever moment I'm in, I try to stay in that moment. And I'm not perfect at this at all. But there's so much value people feel in that, because we go through life alone in some ways, and our bodies are a key component to how we might think about that aloneness. Nobody else is in our bodies. Nobody else has the symptoms we're having. Nobody else has the suffering that we have. But when we connect with people, it feels better. Actually, it was a really interesting thing happened last night. I woke up in the middle of the night, heard my younger daughter crying. By the way, my oldest daughter's name is Zoe, so I just wanted to mention.
Wait, how is it spelled?
Z-O-E.
Okay. Different spelling, but same name.
Okay.
Awesome.
Carved out our different areas. But, my youngest daughter woke up, and she was with my wife, and she was crying. And I was kind of listening out to see, all right, are they getting somewhere? I maybe need to come in and help out. Now, knowing what I know, I thought I probably was going to be needed, because my wife was going away for the day today. And I had a feeling whatever was bothering my daughter physically related to that. So I came in and it turned out her leg was really hurting. Now, when I was a kid and my mom would go away, my knee would hurt. I don't know what it is that she and I shared that kind of thing, but it struck me right away. But the this shows you some things about, you know, we talked a little bit before the podcast about what do you do about these things. Well, there's many different things. Unfortunately, there's many different things you can do, but fortunately, there's many things you can do. So it cuts both ways. In this case, I said to her, are you having feelings about mommy going away? And she was under her blanket. She was huddled under her blanket, but I saw her nod, you know. And I said, you know, I'm going to be here with you, and I'm going to take good care of you, and mommy's going to be back tomorrow night. And I said to her, does that help you? And she nodded. And then she fell asleep in like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, good work. You know, she knows some of this stuff, but it's not the way that she thinks about it. So she's comforting her, saying this won't last. It's going to get better. She's saying all these great things, but the body talks. And all I did was translate the body. Very easy for me to do because I've done it so many times. And I was particularly struck not only about how she relaxed and the pain seemed to go away, but she fell asleep in 30 seconds.
Do you, I'm not even sure how to word this without it sounding stupid, but that question that you ask your daughter is like, are you feeling something about, what was exactly, are you feeling something about mommy leaving? Was that what the quote was?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
there's
been a couple of people on the pod, one in particular that I'm thinking of, Jim Prusak, who's a physical therapist who actually, he works with acute injuries, but in terms of chronic stuff, he doesn't do anything physical anymore. It's all mind body treatment stuff. And the way that he describes feelings, you know, forever, like if I were to walk to a park on a sunny day where there's a ton of parents or a ton of adults or whatever, and I were to say, tell me what a feeling is. Maybe I should do this for a podcast someday. Walk around with a mic and say, tell me what a feeling is. And they would, you know, they would describe things and say anger. They'd say sadness, or they'd say whatever it is that people say. But to you, is feeling a bodily sensation, is that the same thing? Some kind of a sensation in the body and a feeling, is that the same thing?
I'm going to say it might sound extreme, so we can explore it. But most bodily sensations that I have are feelings. So I'm not, you know, there are feelings that don't end up being so bodily, but not usually. I mean, think about it. When you're angry, you're not just angry in your mind. Your heart might race. Your face changes. You know, you can see it. You can see it from a mile away, what's going on with somebody. So their whole body changes. So, yes, I think that most things are most things in the body are feelings. I say this to people sometimes. This one, at the risk of sounding like some kind of crazy mystic, I'm going to say it anyway because I really believe it and I've come to believe it. People rarely sneeze without being upset. The phrase, it's nothing to sneeze at, it comes from that. We don't think about it that way. We think, oh, I just sneeze. We just don't think about it. But if you're as focused in on these kind of issues as I am, and I shouldn't say this is true for everybody, but it's certainly true for people who have a very TMS kind of psychology. To me, I would guess that's everybody, but I don't want to overstate it. But, you know, what happens for me is I'm, you know, working on something and one of my daughters is like, oh, can I have a snack? Chew! Instantly. Because I'm like, I didn't want to be interrupted here. Or I don't even know if that's what the emotion is. But I'm always wondering, what is this symptom about? And I can shift things around based on being pretty certain that or having a mind-body issue. It relates to the doubt kind of discussion we had last time. I don't have a lot of doubt about this, if any.
It's funny that you said the sneeze thing, because my wife has this theory that whenever I yawn, it means I'm upset about something. And she's been saying this for, I mean, way pre-TMS-esque stuff. I mean, we've been together now for, what year is it? Been together for almost 13 years. And anytime I yawn, if she catches me, oh, what's wrong? Do you find the same thing with yawns? I'm just curious.
That yawns have meaning. I don't think it necessarily means upset. I work with somebody, obviously can't reveal anything specific, but we have a joke that he yawns when I'm onto something. When I'm telling him something he didn't know, but at some level he does know, he yawns. So there can be meaning to it. But you know, people yawn for different reasons. Even the word yawn is prone to making people yawn, you know, which is a mind body issue right there. There's contagion of thought. So what I do think is that's so interesting that your wife is making that observation. Now it could be that, I don't know if it's something's wrong. And I don't know. Obviously I don't want to delve too much into your psychology when you don't want me to, at least not on a podcast. But I do think that would be very possible. I've seen that happen. My wife tends to sneeze when I apologize to you for saying this on a podcast, honey. But she tends to sneeze when she's mad at herself. When she does something that she just wishes she hadn't done, she sneezes. And it can be sneezing, it can be yawning, it can be all kinds of different things. Itching.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, there's never an instance where I'm, even if it's super late at night and I'm watching TV or something, like last week I was watching, this is Saturday night, I think, Titanic was on. It's one of those movies that every time I come across it, for some reason, I always turn it on and I just get stuck. I don't know what it is about the story. And then inevitably, I inevitably always end up on Wikipedia researching things about, then I get into shipwrecks and then I get into like mass casualty things and then I get into plane crashes and like it's a whole production, and the movie's long enough. So to be stuck doing all these other things afterward, but,
when it's like a full time watching the Titanic.
Yeah. when it's on TV with commercials, it's 4.5 hours. So like, that's a long time. But when I'm just sitting there and I'm, you know, it's late at night or whatever, and I'm actually tired, I never yawn. It's only during certain conversations. And so I know there's probably something to it. It's some kind of a reaction, of some kind. Okay. So this question keeps burning to me because it's so timely, because it just happened to me overnight. And then when I had mentioned earlier that, I put out on my Facebook group, I said, I'm interviewing Dr. Dan Ratner for part two of our episode from a few weeks back in about an hour and a half. And I'll take a handful of questions if you have something you want to address. And then somebody posted a question about trigger point release. And I had added the disclaimer, Dr. Ratner is a psychotherapist, so questions around emotions and emotional work, please. Unless you have something to add about does pressing on trigger points and rolling them out actually do anything long term. If you want to comment on that, you got the floor.
I appreciate that, and I wish that I could say something particularly intelligent about it, but I guess the main thing that I can say is the mind-body is a complicated and multifaceted apparatus, and I believe there's all kinds of people who know things that I don't know. And so you're talking about like acupressure and things like that?
Yeah, same idea.
So I don't know about that, but I remember one time I had acupuncture. I had somebody come into our grad school and he did acupuncture. He put these needles just in our ears. And I swear to you, I have never been so relaxed in my life afterwards. It was like everything was right in the world.
Yeah.
So I believe there's all kinds of things that can help. I guess the way that I would think about it in relation to what I do is one of two things. Either there's some bodily channel that is getting transformed, and then we can have maybe there's some emotional release there through that method. That I can't speak to particularly intelligently, but I'm open to that idea. And then the other is that the idea that something that we can have help relaxes us and allows our minds to shift somewhere else. And it could be both. In fact, I would guess it is both in those circumstances. But calmness of mind and lack of doubt and feeling good about ourselves, it's tied directly to what's going on in our bodies.
The next one that comes up, and this happened to me overnight as we record this, that I thought this was going to be a lot more of a fun job than it really is, or it's really turned out to be. But I had volunteered for for Zoe, my oldest daughter's Girl Scout troop, to be the cookie manager, and I thought it sounded like a really fun job, and at first it was. But then it just became, it has become, because by the time this airs, cookie season will be well over. But right now we are dead ass in the middle of it. And so my stress and frustration level as pertains to these little $5 boxes is beyond comprehension of what I thought it would be. But, you know, I'm solely in charge of I had tried to tell all the parents and the families that I only want to drive to essentially the warehouse to pick up cookie orders once a week. It's like a 45-minute round trip. I don't want to, you know, I got a job. I got shit to do. I can't be driving back and forth to pick up all these cookies. And inherently, it's happened each of the last 3 weeks where, like, I say I'm going to do it once a day, once a week, here is your deadline. And then the next morning, somebody sends me another one and says, hey, they want. So I end up doing two a week. And it's like, yes, it's another 45 minutes. But then there becomes the issue of, like, all the money then is, we have like a treasure in the troop, but because I'm the one that's in charge of all the cookie boxes, and if there are unaccounted for ones, I have to pay for that. So it's like, you may be the one that's the treasure, but I'm still the one that's in charge of all the money, basically. So I got this email. I keep getting this email from one of the moms that she'll send it after every time I place an order, but she says, I need to know how many of each type each girl in the troop ordered. And I'm kind of just like, I'm like so fucking over that question, because there's not like an easy way. Girls, I mean, it's a nonprofit. So like the app that you use to do it is not super friendly in that way. I can't go and look and see what each kid ordered. I can look and see a total for the troop, but then it involves me going into every email that every parent has sent me with an order in it and deducting and doing it that way. I'm like, I just don't have time for this. So I wake up at 2 in the morning, and I'm just like lit up about this. It is making me, with all of the fury that my mind can emote in the middle of the night, and I just cannot fall back asleep. This went on for an hour and 50 minutes. I was looking at my Fitbit sleep. You know, it's like I was like deep, and then I was like REM, and then I was up, and it just stays flatline up for 2 hours. Yep. And then somebody came in with this question, and it's very similar to this. So he says, I have a chronically tight, sore glute and hamstring. Since I've started down the TMS road, I'm 90 to 100% pain-free during the day, mainly because of the breath work I do, feeling my emotions and meditation. I'm 100% convinced this is TMS. My main issue is with sleeping at night. My leg almost always throbs, and my hamstring muscle feels pulled and tight, even if I lay on my side. What would you do to calm the nervous system enough so that while you are asleep, the tension releases? I guess it's not exactly the same thing, but I ended up figuring out a way to fall asleep, but I was just swirling, and I just could not slow myself down.
I mean, it is the same question, at least from the vantage point of how do you calm the nervous system down at certain times? And, you know, there can be times where we feel certain limitations, and, this is one of the reasons I've had to develop multiple kinds of interventions with myself, is because different times call for different measures. What I would say is, I'm going to give a couple of answers, and I'll try to keep it, you know, concise enough. But first of all, I think that one of the places I look when there's a lot of pain going on at night, but there's not much going on during the day, is I ask, are you aware of your dreams? A lot of times people who are having that are not so aware of their dreams. So as a result, I find that becoming aware of your dreams is a way to be more actively engaged with your emotional life while you're asleep and not have it play out bodily. So that's one answer. But I will say there's something deeper in that, which is, I can almost anticipate the next question. How do I become more aware of my dreams?
You stole it right out of my mouth. Okay.
Ah, there we go. Well, the way you become more aware of your dreams is by being more aware of your feelings in waking life. It carries into your asleep life. So it's not really I want to take back something I said a little bit. It's not really that you're, you know, aware of everything in your daytime experience and then you're just not aware of your dreams. As people go through therapy, they start remembering their dreams more because they're just working on it. It's getting closer to the surface. And that's when you start to remember your dreams. So it really is an issue of deciding to invest in being aware of yourself and fully what's going on. So one of the things I loved in your story about, first of all, Cookie Man sound like it should be a good job. I mean, who doesn't want to manage the cookies? But as it turns out, you're more of a money manager and a feelings manager, and the cookies are not, they're just in the box. You're right. Not getting to manage them much.
Right.
But what I loved about that story is that you were recognizing that something that seems small isn't necessarily small. You know, I don't know the details of your life in this way, but what I do in a situation like that is I say to myself, how does this mirror the big things in my life? This is another way that you can become more aware of your feelings during the day, and then they'll show up at night in your dreams. You have to think about what's the big picture here. So for you, I don't know, maybe being heaped up with far more responsibility than you felt you could cope with or felt you deserved, or maybe you didn't feel appreciated at different times. These bigger themes, they matter. And the more that we go through them during the day and think about them, the better. And actually, when I'm having symptoms during the day, I immediately think emotionally about that. I, you know, like if I'm having a symptom, let's say in my back or leg or whatever, I think, what's bothering me? And it's always about what's happening right then. So that brings us back to this question about what's happening at nighttime for this person who asked the question. There also could be some things about nighttime that they need to think about. What's bothering me about this? Maybe, you know, nighttime is hard for kids, which means it's going to be hard for adults too. One of the reasons it's hard for kids is it's a very alone experience, and it can be very scary to really little kids. Like, what happens to me during sleep? There's all kinds of questions, and we carry these forward into our adulthood. So I tend to think about separation from other people and aloneness when it comes to sleep. And I think to think about that before you're going to sleep, just to be aware of it is good. I don't mean to dwell on it. And then the last thing I'll say about it is related to doubt. We get into feedback loops with ourselves about doubt. When I had this terrible back pain for 8 years, I couldn't lie on my left side. Couldn't do it. It was all had to be on my right side. Didn't make any sense to me. I was like, What sense does that make? It didn't even really relate to the physical symptoms. But what had happened is I had had more spasming that way, and so I had more doubt to work through in that position. My guess is that a person who is 90 to 100% free during the day but not at night also is struggling with doubt. And I think if you can push on that doubt and say, no, you know what? If I can challenge myself that I really can believe this can get under control, that will bring the nervous system down. Just that. I'm not saying it necessarily will solve the whole problem, but if it doesn't, then awareness and dream work is the way to go.
The dream work thing is really fascinating. So you're just saying that, because this just came up a couple days ago in a group text I'm in, which is all with women. And that's, I follow the theme of what you were talking about earlier, because despite having three brothers, no sisters, 99% of my friends in my life have been women, and that's always how it's been. And then I end up being the girl dad, and you know, that's how life is shaken out. But I just always feel, I don't know. It's almost like I sort of have, even when I go to like sales meetings, if it's with a male that is an authority figure, I feel intimidated, I would say, in a way. But with a female, I immediately feel at ease. Like, I got this, like, we're good. We're just talking. So the dream, but with the dream stuff, they were talking in this group chat about like this one woman. She had said, you know, what I would give to remember my dreams. She's like, I wish I could get to that point. And they were just kind of all talking back and forth about this exact thing that they, and I think a lot of them have sleep issues a lot. You know, mine's kind of racing at night. And they all, they have a variety of backgrounds and what they do with their lives. And there's so many variables that are involved there. So like sometimes when my buddies and I, my two male friends, when we talk about like sleep habits, cause we share our sleep scores, like our Fitbit sleep scores in the morning, every morning. When my score is really high, or when my buddy Pete's score is really high, I'm like, oh, what did you do? And he said, I took a micro dose of CBD. And then he asked me, what did I do that mine was so high? I said, I did a micro dose of journaling. That's what I had said to him. which sometimes really works. And so, this conversation was coming up amongst my female friends that they were just saying that, they wish they could remember their dreams, and they've tried magnesium and now they're going to try melatonin, and they, so there's like a variety of like external things to try. But you're saying that the dream stuff would inherently get better and you would remember them better just simply by being more aware while you're awake. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. In my experience, the people who have come to therapy for me, their dreams have become things they remember much more often just over time.
Yeah.
I've had people come to me who never remember dreams at all, and years later, they're dream after dream after dream.
The next question, and it's about doubt, because which is good because you've just talked a lot about it. So she says he talked a lot about doubt last time. Oh, good, she listened to it. And some suggestions on overcoming lingering doubt, even if you have been diagnosed with TMS by a TMS doctor, would be great. Also, does he feel that this is the biggest hindrance in people who have seen some results but just can't seem to get rid of symptoms completely?
Two great questions, and thank you for listening, listener. I'm thinking about suggestions about doubt. I made reference to this last time, but one of the things you're going to need to do is to figure out the specifics of your doubt. As I've said, I think I said this last time, it has to make sense to you. So I can give you general ways that could work for you. For instance, some people need to see the science of it. So I have a whole list of scientific studies. I have them, categorized somewhere. And actually the PPD website has this. That's the best place to go for that. Some people need to see the science of it. Some people may need to be reading a book so that they're engaging with the voice of it. But mostly what you need to do is figure out what are your questions. What's not making sense to you? Why do you feel like you wouldn't get better? And then we need to get answers to it. How does one get the answers to it? Well, I do think that sometimes it can help to consult with somebody. I had this great experience. Didn't feel great at the time because where I still was with things, but I was working with a therapist who I wasn't really getting along with very well at the time. He was the only therapist that I felt that way about. A male, by the way, so we should get more into toxic masculinity. I think on there. But I had just discovered Sarno, and I went to see Eric Sherman. And I thought, okay, maybe this guy can kind of just consult about this, because I knew that I didn't want to see two therapists at once. It didn't feel like that was kosher. But I went and to talk to him, and he confirmed that he was like, yeah, I can't really see you if you're seeing another therapist. I don't want to get in the way of that relationship. And at the time, I was really like crushed by it, just because I was like, I need the help. I need it so badly, and I feel like you are the one who can do it. But here's what I did, and this relates to that doubt question. I asked him every question that I was doubting about. That was partly on instinct, but this is how I learned how important doubt is. I asked him every question. I said, can it be caused by another person being difficult in your life? He said, no, it doesn't matter how difficult they are. Sure, that's not great, but it's something that's going on inside you in your relationship to yourself. It allowed me to put questions to rest. So when people are having doubt, often it's about articulating the questions. You said something like that before about putting a feeling into words is not as easy as it sounds. So we often need to help the person articulate the questions they have. So a little bit of a dialogue with anybody, really. It doesn't even have to be a TMS practitioner, you could just have a conversation where people say, okay, well, what are your doubts? Why do you worry maybe this isn't TMS? Why do you worry maybe you are – that other people can do it, but somehow you can't? So I don't – hopefully I'm being clear about that, but there's many different areas that doubts can happen. And what you need to do is articulate them and then figure out how to get those questions answered. And you will know best how to answer your own questions. But if you're not sure how to do it, I would consult with a TMS practitioner who understands the doubt perspective. And there are a couple, some that I did some training for. So they think similarly to this. But I would say, reach out to me. I'll point you in the right direction. But you need to get your questions articulated and then answered. Now, the second question she asked was, it was a woman, right?
Yes, it's Christina. She's a common listener, great woman. She's had, I think that she was one of the people that, she was allergic to 50 foods and was down to eating like the same five things. And I think most of that stuff is gone.
Awesome. I'm glad for you, Christina. So the question I think was, is doubt kind of the most central thing? Can you repeat the question? I want to make sure I got it.
Does he feel that this is the biggest hindrance in people who have seen some results but can't get rid of symptoms completely?
Yes, I absolutely do. But I want to break it down into two types of doubt, actually. As I said last time, acute symptoms tend to relate to emotions. Chronic symptoms tend to relate to doubt. And so I do think doubt is the most central piece of this. But some people have doubt that relates to these unarticulated questions, or maybe articulated questions where they haven't felt convinced, either one. That's part of doubt. But there's another part of doubt, and I've found this with a couple of people that I work with. There's something that I call plateaus, where you recover to a certain point, but you can't get past that. It sounds like what Christine is talking about. I don't know for sure, but and this may or may not apply to her, but sometimes when that happens, there's doubt about the self. There's doubt about whether the self is good. So I'm going to talk about one person that I work with. I'm going to keep it pretty general for confidentiality, but I know she won't mind my sharing this. She's someone who, she's actually very critical of herself about having TMS. So she has accepted she has TMS. It has helped her. She's gone a long way, but she can't get past a certain point because she doesn't want to accept that it's okay to have TMS. So sometimes there's doubt about the self and whether the self is okay. I have another one that I'm working with who he has doubts about whether he's valuable to other people. And sometimes we have to alleviate those deeper doubts. So actually, Sarno makes reference to the fact in his books that, I think he says like 2% of people need to go to see a therapist to get issues worked at better. I think, first of all, that percentage is way too low. I think that a lot of people need some extra help, especially because of doubt purposes, but some of them because they've got something kind of standing in the way of letting themselves be powerful, feel better, be fine. There's all kinds, it can get complicated. So doubt can come essentially in two main forms, unarticulated questions or articulated questions that you need answers to. And you do need them because it's your mind that has to be convinced. Or something in the personality that isn't allowing you to move. And fortunately, I find neither ones are slow to fix. I can pinpoint even the personality side very well so that you can start thinking about the right issues. Again, long-winded answer. I apologize, but hopefully that's helpful.
No, those are very helpful. I think the doubt, I had a couple of people that had said that they were so happy that you were talking about doing an entire episode on doubt, because I think that it is very problematic. I mean, I don't have them so much anymore, but I was probably, I mean, I was a good year into even doing this podcast, maybe not quite a year, where I was still, I'd still every, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks, I would kind of have these moments of like, is this really what it is? Like, maybe that maybe that one chiropractor I didn't call knows it.
Exactly.
Like knows what to do, or knows that, you know, maybe it is a fascia restriction on some obscure muscle in my back. Right. So I still would have those, moments, you know, a year into doing this show sometimes. And so I know, you know, I know how that feels and it sucks.
I can relate very much. I always was thinking, but what about the one stone unturned? Mm-hmm. You know, but what happened is I worked it out with myself. I thought about what my doubts were and I worked on them. One doubt I had, this I think will probably crack some people up, but it really was a major one for me, is can this be true given that I want it to be true?
Right.
I was like, this is too good to be true. can I really believe something is true that works this well, that is something I really want? I actually can control this and I can get rid of it. That was hard for me to believe, honestly. I don't know if that sounds silly, but that was a big piece of doubt for me to get past. It's like, I'm worried that I'm corrupting my view of logic because I want it to be true. Turned out that's not the case, but that was a doubt I had to alleviate. And I had to be pretty thorough to do that.
There's a couple of, hold on. I need to write this question down before I forget it. Bear with me for 12 seconds.
Sure.
Because there's two questions that don't really have anything to do with each other, and one's looking right at me, and one is not. So where are you at with, I don't know a better word to describe than external means, but when it's things like breath work and meditation, it's worked for a lot of people. So I guess maybe the question becomes, why does it work for a lot of those people? Because a lot of people don't do any of that kind of stuff. So, and I know that, you know, like if you were to Google, how do you, this is what I thought would be the you know, the silver bullet at first, was Googling how do you calm down the or how do you activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And it's kind of like usually there's a list of a few things, and the first one inherently is almost always breath work. So like we know that that's a thing, but some people do it and it works great, and some people do it and it doesn't do anything outside of the 5 minutes that you're doing it. So what's your take on breath, things like breath work and meditation? For this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, let me say that breathwork and meditation I have found to be really valuable for lots of people, including myself. I don't meditate as often as I wish I would, but it's a really cool experience that is very helpful. And it is, you know, I read Herbert Benson's book, blanking on the name, The Relaxation Response, I think it's called. And it really is true. There is a method to reducing bodily symptoms. But I want to encourage the people that it doesn't work for. But that doesn't mean you're failing in some way. What it probably relates to is you've got different parameters that you need to address to calm down the nervous system. So I guess what I would say about it is some things work for some people because it fits with what they needed. Some people just needed to know, okay, look, I have some control. I can calm myself down. Maybe that's enough for them. But maybe for another person, they think, okay, great, I can calm myself down, but it only lasts 5 minutes. And then what? You know, so what we have to do is have a broader answer. And here's the way I think about it. Any solution that only addresses one facet doesn't satisfy me. It leaves me with too many questions. And I often say, the smarter you are, the more doubt you're going to have. Because the corollary is not true. It's not like if you don't have doubts, you're stupid. I want to make sure to say that. But I do think that really smart people can really back themselves into lots of corners with questions and doubts and worries. So those people maybe can relax themselves with the breathing, but they come right back up and their mind is really active. So and I'm like that. So meditation sometimes can help, and sometimes it can't. Sometimes my mind is really racing. So I think the key is to think about it not as one thing is the solution, but actually the mind-body interaction is the solution. And how we think about that is the solution, because it's multifaceted. It reminds me of, I can't remember if I said this in the first episode that we did, but Sarno talked about oxygen deprivation. And what he said made a lot of sense, but it did leave me with a question, which is, that doesn't feel like it explains everything. So, and why is that happening? It just left me with too many questions. So as I explored it, I actually basically followed his own advice. He said I think it was in The Divided Mind, he said, read Candace Pert's Molecules of Emotion. Or he just even quoted her. I don't even remember if he said to read it, but I was like, okay, I'm going to read it. So I read it and I found something really important that settled a question for me, is that there are these things in our bodies called peptides. Peptides are basically like neurotransmitters, but they can travel in the bloodstream. And so what it means is the mind can control every cell in the body in whatever way it wants to. If the body can do it for one reason, it can do it for another reason, a psychological reason. So if the body's capable of the relaxation response, there's going to be multiple methods that get you there. For some people, it might be breathing. For some people, it might be, you know what, when I do puzzles, I just relax. For some people, it might be, you know what, I've got to get this psychologically put away. I've got to get a handle on it that really works for me. So I was going through, a stressful period recently. And one of the things that really calmed me down was remembering what matters. I remembered what matters. And basically, for the most part, it's my daughters. You know, at base, if they're okay and I'm here with them and we've got a roof over our heads, I'm okay.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty easy to forget that, because life can be very stressful for very legitimate reasons. I said this last time and I think it made us both laugh, that the answer sometimes can just be it depends, but I don't want to leave that as, that's a very unsatisfying answer. I mean, depends in a very positive way, meaning there's many ways to get this done. Learn about you and what you need and trust yourself. And if you need help figuring that out, you can get help for that.
What would you, and it's tough as a therapist in this field to maybe completely objectively answer this question. Not that I'm saying that you're trying to sell anything or anything like that, but if Sarno was, I think the exact number he said was like 3% don't need psychotherapy and they'll be fine, basically just reading the book or, you know, doing the journaling exercises he recommends in the Mind-Body Prescription or the Divided Mind. What do you think the real, let's give it 1 year. For somebody from the time that they have heard of TMS and they do kind of the normal thing that a lot of us do where they read all the books and then they try the journaling and they try all these things. Let's give it like 1 year. What do you think the real percentages of, does that make sense as a question? Like, what do you think of percentages of people that should do therapy, that have TMS or that probably will require it? I mean, or is that too tough of a question to even really quantify?
It's a little tough to quantify, but I'm going to try anyway. And these are guesses, but, and like you said, I'm not trying to sell therapy here. What I really want to sell is connection with self, love of self, feeling powerful, and resolving your questions so that you can be at peace. It's very hard to be at peace when you've got a question there. And I had so many questions, so I couldn't be at peace. So whether it's through therapy or some other method, you've got to connect with yourself. The percentage that I think – look, the percentage that can benefit from therapy is huge. It's 99.99999% to almost everybody.
Yep.
But I think it actually, I really want to say this, and hopefully this will be helpful to hear from a therapist saying this. There are people where therapy is not the best answer for them, where they need another method. You know, I think there are people like I went to high school with who did Outward Bound or something, and it opened up something in them. Or there are people who tap into their creative experience and it completely changes them. So it doesn't have to be therapy. I think it's all about connecting with the self. And the percentage of people that need to connect with themselves better to get better from TMS is 100%.